This is the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast from Advanta IRA, where we show you how to explore investments beyond Wall Street and open your eyes to new options for your portfolio. It's time to take control and give yourself the freedom to choose where you invest your money.
Welcome to another edition of the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. My name is Alex Perney, and today we are very pleased to welcome on Lane Kawaoka, the author of The Wealth Elevator and owner of $2.1 billion of assets under management and 10,000 doors, or 10,000 units, I should say. We are very pleased to welcome you on today. It's always great when we have people that have a good basis of knowledge in investing, and I think those metrics certainly do speak to that. So I'll let you give a little bit of a brief introduction to yourself, and we'll kind of go from there. I'm really excited to talk about what we have going on today with kind of demystifying what people normally think of as what they are required to do with their personal finance. You know, there's a lot of myths out there pertaining to especially retirement plans and investing that you kind of have to look at Wall Street for all of your answers. And that's really not the case. There's a lot of wealth to be generated, made, and earned throughout other alternative avenues. So Lane, thank you very much for being on with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Alex. Aloha, everybody.
Yeah, so if you could just give a brief introduction about yourself and kind of how you came to be in your current franchise in life, that'd be great.
Yeah, so I call this a linear path. You know, I was kind of taught to go to school, study hard, be an engineer. We weren't poor, broke growing up, but we weren't super rich. I guess we were part of the middle class for whatever that is today. But, you know, became an engineer and just started to work for the man. I wasn't a very good engineer going through college. So what does a bad engineer do but be a project manager and manage projects? So that's where I kind of found myself right after college in 2007. And again, following this linear path of maxing out my 401k and saving up to buy a house to live in. At this time, I was in Seattle, Washington, and, you know, bought a house to live in my early 20s. And I, because my job put me over, like, you know, all over for work, as a lot of young professionals are working on the road, I just kind of on a whim decided to house hack my house. Home at and actually rent it out. And that was kind of the taste of cash flow and, you know, kind of realizing, wow, there's a different way of, you know, growing my net worth outside of the 401k stuff. And that was kind of the chink in the armor that kind of led me down this path of, you know, alternative investing, tax savings, and, you know, kind of ultimately led to the road of, you know, the entrepreneurship. But I think that was, you know, everybody needs that first step into this world. And then you start to go down the rabbit holes. That was kind of what it was for me.
Great. Yeah, it's always good to kind of start at the beginning with this. And, you know, being, in your own words, a bad engineer, what do you do except project manage? I think that kind of leads pretty well into commercial real estate, because a lot of it is managing different aspects of projects. Certainly not anything on as, you know, maybe a analytical or maybe a mathematical level as engineering, but certainly some of those skills definitely apply with how to analyze things that are going on in actions and reactions within a certain asset class. You know, I think the people that I've seen that have done very well in this space, a lot of them do have some type of, you know, mathematical or engineering background. I think those skills, you know, tend to lend very well into this space. So we'd like to start at the beginning with any of our guests. So you initially house hacked in Seattle, and then you kind of got the bug for real estate. So, you know, no one typically dives headfirst into the pool of commercial real estate and getting, you know, 10,000 different units. So kind of how did it progress from there for you? Like, what were the kind of the things that said, okay, was it a throughput issue? Was it a time management issue that made you want to go from the single family to the multifamily space? And what did that progression look like?
Yeah, I mean, I did single family homes from 2009 to about 2015. So it took a while. You know, like I said, I wasn't broke. I had a good paying engineering salary, but a lot of the limiting factor was just saving up down payment money. I think at the time I was able to save maybe 50 grand on average in that period of my life. I started to invest out of state. You know, Seattle, Washington is a primary market. It's very expensive there, especially the rent to value ratios are very low. So in 2012, I started to play around with buying turnkey rentals out in Birmingham, Atlanta, Indianapolis. Got 11 of those things, which, you know, I mean, I think for non-accredited investors, great way to get started, but, you know, definitely not scalable. I think, you know, people are interested in building a big portfolio and maxing out their 10 Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac slots per you and your spouse, you know, 10, 11 rental properties. You know, maybe I had an eviction or two every year, some kind of big catastrophe that happened every quarter. And it's just, you know, of course, I had a full-time job and I used professional property management to do all kind of the dirty work for me. But it was a bit of a management headache to manage the manager. And for 10, 11 rentals at a few hundred bucks of pure cash flow each, that's not much, like a few grand a month. And then you need to scale that portfolio to 30 homes, at least to get to that magic 10 grand a month number to be anything meaningful for most people out there. I'm sorry if I'm being offensive, but I'm speaking to most accredited investors out there. You know, you're going to need $10,000 to $20,000 of passive cash flow to kind of set yourself on financial independence. And the single family homes just are not scalable. And then, you know, you never want to own a home for more than 10, 20 years, because then that tidal wave of CapEx comes into play, which is kind of why we, you know, when we buy apartments, we try and get out before, you know, 5-10 years. We don't want to get hit by that because it's kind of a train set hitting the slack on you. But that was where in 2016, like I said, I had 11 rental properties and I was kind of, I got out of my shell. Like up until that point, I was just an introverted engineer, just doing it all by myself. And this is where I kind of met other accredited investors. Up until this point, you know, like my family, I didn't have any rich uncles, any accredited investors in my network. And this is, you know, when I started to uncover and meet other people, I think that's a big thing for most investors. You start to understand that there's other strategies out there. And then everything kind of leads to a T, you know, investing in private placements and syndications, the tax strategies, you know, using these types of self-directed IRAs or different, you know, other kind of, you know, tax strategies. And in a way, like I uncovered the best practices for the wealthy. And what kind of frustrated me was a lot of this stuff was very implementable by everybody out there, but it clashes completely with what Dave Ramsey tells you and, you know, a lot of the FIRE bloggers out there and what you normally hear from people. And that was kind of where kind of went on this mission to, you know, uncover those best practices and kind of share them and create this community.
Fantastic. So what are some of those best practices that you just, I mean, it's a good segue if there is any. And everyone kind of has their own, you know, idea of what that looks like. But I always do like to get people with a refreshing take on things, especially, you know, good, bad, or indifferent. I also don't necessarily agree with a lot of stuff that Dave Ramsey kind of puts out there. You know, I think certainly saving rainy day funds, you know, debt for, you know, the consumer market is not necessarily a great thing. But, you know, how do you scale anything unless you're born with $1 billion? You know, debt is certainly going to be a component of that. You know, not many people are going out and buying $30 million apartment buildings with cash. So certainly there is a place for it. So what are some of those kind of best practices that you kind of developed and identified that really helped you in that transition?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think a lot of it comes down to like where you are in the wealth building journey. And there are different types of strategies and mindsets based on where you are at. You know, Dave Ramsey, you know, we both know him and I think a lot of people know him. Like, I think they're great for when you're, you know, in debt or under $250,000 net worth, right? Like most people need to learn how to keep a budget. But what do you do like when I was in my 20s as a non-accredited investor? Well, buy rental properties. But at some point when your net worth goes over $500,000, $1 million, or certainly when you're an accredited investor from an income standpoint, investing in syndications and private placements. And that was kind of where, you know, like my new book, The Wealth Elevator, has a chart in there based on where your net worth is, and all these different floors represent a different strategy paradigm. And that's kind of the big thing is, I mean, it's kind of hard to go on a podcast form, right? But I think most of the people listening that you kind of mentioned are, you know, they have significant net worth where, you know, it's either buying rental properties, which I call the first floor of the wealth elevator, or the second floor of the wealth elevator, which is kind of where I was in 2016, trading the single family homes in for more scalable private placements and syndications. But what I'd say is like, if you're under $1 million net worth, the traditional investments are not going to do it for you, right? That's the stuff that Wall Street and all these big companies want you to do. Why? Because the returns aren't that great. And that it's, unless you invest in an IRA or a 401k that your company sponsors, the taxes, I mean, it's sheltered for now, but you're going to have to pay the taxes on it at some point, and you're not going to be able to self-direct it into real estate or other alternative investments. So what I distill down when I talk to folks, and I try and this is what's difficult, right? It's hard to get like these more intimate knowledge of people's portfolios, is to ask the question, like, what percentage of your net worth right now is alternative investments? I see thousands of financial profiles where I get this type of information. And for take a guy who's 45 years old, typically their net worth hasn't gone over $1.5, $2 million because they're doing it the traditional way. But if they're doing it with more than 30 to 50% alternative investments, they could be double or triple that of their counterpart. So that's evidence for me to believe that you've, when you're starting out, you really got to take it above that 30, 50, maybe even 70% of alternative investments in your portfolio. And that was kind of my story, right? When I was in my early 20s and my net worth was under $500,000, maybe even under $250,000, in a way, I sort of went all in, of course, in a diversified pool of assets, single family homes, different locations, but 80 to 90% of it was in alternative investments. And so I would look at it like that first.
Yeah, and I think that's really kind of a good illustration, is that I would challenge anyone to look, you know, externally from yourself or in maybe your own network, and look at the people that, you know, think the wealthiest out there, and think about how they make their money or what they actually invest in, if you know, or even look broader to this, you know, the societal level. Unless the people are, you know, working on Wall Street or they are in finance, how many of those people do you realistically think got wealthy or generated wealth to any meaningful degree by just investing in the stock market? You know, you could certainly have some security there. You know, there is an argument to be made that the stock market definitely has its place. But I would argue to say that most of them have a good basis of alternative assets, you know, whether that is private businesses. A big common denominator between all of them is going to be real estate in some form or fashion. You know, even the, you know, biggest, most wealthiest people out there, they don't just have a stock portfolio. It's going to be some type of alternatives. And granted, I wholeheartedly disagree with calling real estate an alternative asset simply because, you know, the Romans invested in real estate. You know, they didn't have a stock market. You know, they weren't
what,
going to
the NASDAQ. More traditional can you get than real estate,
yeah,
right?
You know, real estate has been, you know, the primary driver of nations and empires in for millennia. You know, that's what people conquered and owned and generated massive empires was real estate. So to call it alternative, again, my own little kind of crusade that I don't necessarily like, but for the context of what people are talking about, thinking of real estate and especially alternatives being kind of a cornerstone of some of the wealthiest or most successful people that you can either identify in your own nuclear group of people or in the broader, again, societal context should really start to illustrate the benefit of looking at things a little bit differently. And for no other reason than just think about the how and the why of it. Is the how getting to a place going to get you there with stocks and bonds? Well, unless you can have a, you know, a crystal ball and say this stock's going to go up, which, you know, for the uneducated, stock investing individually is basically akin to gambling. But you can always say, you know, people are always going to need a place to live. You know, they're not making any more real estate. They're making new companies every day. But you know, understanding the scarcity, understanding the economics behind it is not that difficult. And the benefits are almost immeasurable. And there's so many different ways to get involved in these types of assets that there's going to be something that fits well for almost anyone. Whether you are, again, starting out, like you said, you know, in your 20s in Seattle, whether you're someone like myself, or again, someone that is a little bit late to this, there's an avenue into this for you. And it doesn't take a, you know, an economics degree from Harvard to understand real estate. You know, it can be very granular. It can be very high level, and there's, you know, somewhere to sit at the table to eat for almost everyone. So again, my thoughts on it, but what I would like to kind of dive into this with you is, you know, certainly you've written a book on the topic of different kind of paradigms in this whole, you know, thought of personal finance, and you know, you call it your wealth elevator, and there's different levels to that. So I'd like you to kind of enumerate on. I think we've kind of covered that first one of identifying, what you want to do, and or identifying at least how to better improve the current franchise and figuring out how your capital can be deployed. So what are some of the other aspects of this that you feel can help people be more successful in this realm of finance?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think that the wealth elevator, like, it also illustrates, like, hey, there's different floors above you, right? And I think that's where I was back in 2015 when I thought I was hot stuff, right? Maybe my net worth was a little bit of under $1 million at that point. I think I was maybe in my mid to late 20s. But that was kind of where I had a little humble pie when I started to interact with other credit investors. You know, still they were a lot older than myself at the time, but it kind of put me in my place and realized like there is another shelf to this and there's another shelf above that. And that was kind of where I realized like, you know, I'm doing well, but I shouldn't compare myself to my other cohorts, my friends, family doing the old traditional 401k stuff. And this may come across as a shock. If you're in your mid 40s and you've got less than $1.5 million, you may feel like you're doing well, but when you connect with other people within this kind of ecosystem of alternative investors and throwing out even the second generation folks, right? The people who already had money, right? That's given, right? When you compare yourself with first generation millionaires, like who we all are here, I mean, you've got a lot of place to go still. Right. Mm-hmm. And like I said, unless you're investing a good, healthy chunk of your net worth in alternative investments, I just don't see people getting there. Maybe that's correlation than causation, but that's kind of what I see is in terms of the data coming in. I do think that at some point when you hit a concept, what I call end game, which I define as like $4 to $5 million net worth. I call this kind of the penthouse level on the chart in the book. But, you know, once you get up to that level, then, yeah, maybe you can take your foot off the pedal and go away from alternatives to a certain extent and maybe put your money into some of those traditional investments that we don't like. Right. But, you know, it's all this idea where you're accelerating up to that $3, $4, or $5 million net worth and then kind of going to cruise control at that point. Which at that point, then you're these self-directed IRAs that Avanta guys do, then it becomes more of a focus at that point. But, you know, now we're kind of getting a little technical, I think. And I think that every personal situation is a little bit different. But if, you know, for the engineers out there, you guys kind of understand it's not like a constant grind to get to a point. There's somewhat of a curve and a crest. As sort of what I see as kind of the optimal path to getting to financial independence.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point to make is that it's not a, you know, it's not a precipitous like direct climb up. It is a curve, even though the analogy you use is an elevator. You know, the stuff is not, you know, necessarily just a, you know, again, you don't just cross the bottom portion of the graph and then go directly straight to the top. It is going to be bell curved in nature when looking at it. And again, to your point about IRAs, the other part I kind of like to illustrate with this is that when it comes to looking at portfolios, the big thing that people don't realize is that, you know, we live in a great country where you can, you know, invest however you want to. If you want to take all of your net worth and put it on black at the casino, power to you. But you have really innumerable options to go out there and invest. But when it comes to looking at things like retirement plans, 401ks, IRAs, people more often not think that they're just in this little cube of saying, oh, well, you know, my 401k is with Vanguard, my IRA is at Fidelity, which nothing, not speaking ill of either of those institutions, but they don't realize that there's options outside of that. And being able to utilize that ratio of alternative assets that you are doing personally is very powerful when you start expanding it into tax advantaged accounts, when you can say, okay, great. Well, I would like to be able to make some of these returns and either defer my taxation or not pay any taxes, depending on what type of an account you're in. So, you know, to not stand on a soapbox too much, considering that's what I do as a job. It's important to understand that these kind of things that we're talking about here can be applied to not only your personal finance, but also your retirement finance. And it's not that you have to take out a distribution, pay taxes and be like, oh, I'm just using it as another chunk of personal stuff. There's people out there, you know, raising my hand for that one, that can actually assist in actually doing that directly. So an important thing to actually notate on that. Is there any kind of additional items that you'd like to enumerate on at least like your core concepts of those five levels of your book?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'll kind of bring in the framework of like the way I look at wealth building. It's kind of like filling up three different buckets in sequential order. Because the question always comes up, right? When do I fill up my retirement accounts, right? Vanguard and Fidelity want me to fill it up first so that they can put it into their 401k stock or mutual funds, right? But obviously, we live in a different world, right, of alternative investors and obviously different mindsets and strategies. So what is it in this world? And I've kind of come up with this idea of like filling up these three buckets of money first, which is the first bucket is your cash flow today bucket. Right. You know, maybe that's rental properties, maybe that's syndications, or, you know, it's stuff that kind of creates cash flow right now so that when you do quit your job, you can live off of it. But going back to that earlier concept that I mentioned before, end game, right? When you have enough money to be able to kick off and fulfill that first bucket today, the today cash flow bucket, then you've kind of now filling up that second bucket, which is the legacy bucket. And at this point, it's the reason why it's legacy is because you're not going to really be needing to spend it. If you've got $20,000 of passive cash flow a month, which, you know, just throwing that number out, because that's typically what our clients will usually use as kind of that barometer for that first, you know, satisfying daily needs and expenses and going on first class and living a good life, right? You don't really need anything more than that. So you kind of punt it to the next generation. And that's where these self-directed IRA accounts, are a great mechanism to kind of passing that wealth down when you don't really have to use it. People always ask, well, what the heck is the third bucket? Well, there's other some more advanced tax strategies, irrevocable trusts and nonprofits that act in similar ways. But, you know, unless you've got $10, $20 million net worth, you don't really trigger that. But I kind of just bring it up and, you know, people always like, yeah, right. Let's fill up today first, right? Fill up today's cash flow, then we fill up the legacy buckets, you know, sequentially after. But that's kind of, in a way, that's kind of as we go through these different floors of the wealth elevator, right? Going from, you know, starting as a non-accredited investor, then an early accredited investor, then getting to that $4 or $5 million net worth endgame level. You know, that's typically the goal for most of my folks, right? Is just to get to that level. And you don't need to get to eight figures. Yeah, you'll probably get to there when you're 70, 80 years old. And I guess people live to 100 these days, or probably will in our generation. But, you know, just get to that point so that you can kind of take your foot off the gas pedal in a way and kind of enjoy life. Then I think, at least speaking for myself, you know, I'm always like a recovering scarcity mindset person, right? Save, 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 save. The last decade of my life was all about, you know, maximizing the savings there. Of course, I'm still going to have my latte. I don't follow those silly rules. But, you know, moving as quickly as we can to like a set point, call it $3, $4, $5 million, right? Different for everybody, different lifestyle needs. But then kind of enjoying, and, you know, people have read the book Die with Zero. He was kind of on our podcast, and great book by Bill Perkins. It kind of explains this whole concept of, you know, yeah, you work hard, you save hard, you invest well. But at some point you need to kind of enjoy it, because what is it all for?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the adage of you can't take it with you is, you know, something you need to realize. And, you know, scarcity mindset can be good to a point, you know, just like anything. It's kind of an odd statement about to say, scarcity mindset in moderation.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great. I call it hustle culture. I think it's great for most people out there who haven't saved $100,000 to save their life. I mean, more people need that. But I think speaking to people actually listening to a financial podcast, you guys are somewhat self-selecting into the camp where you need to relax a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. You know, make sure that you enjoy the fruits of your labor. And if the most enjoyment you get out of there is just watching your investments grow and your bank account grow, then who's to say? Again, great country, you can do what you want to with your wealth. But just remember, if you're investing for a certain thing, don't always keep shifting the goalposts, saying, oh, well, when I get to X, it's going to be great. And when I get to X and you keep achieving these goals, well, what are the goals for? You know, like, also keep in mind the mindset that goes behind all of this. It's not, you know, and again, it certainly can be, but, you know, making sure that if you set these goals, have some type of reward for it. Don't just let it be something that you achieve and you set the next one. Enjoy life. We only get one of them, right? So yeah. What I'd like to transition a little bit into is specific asset classes. Now, alternative assets, basically for the broad context, just means anything that's not a stock, bond, or mutual fund traded on a financial market. You know, in the broad concept, a lot of alternative assets are stock-based. They're going to be some type of private stock offering, a limited partnership, private LLCs, trusts, and any other number of, you know, if you can think it up, I've seen it, you know, in the contract of what I do at Advanta, you know, just to illustrate how alternative things can get, I had a client years ago that was buying and selling burial crypts and made a killing doing it within his IRA and paid no taxes. So he was avoiding the taxes and then profiting on the death. I guess it was kind of an odd concept, but he made it work. But from the asset classes that you look at, is it, again, wholly focused on real estate? What kind of other areas do you branch into? Or are there some that you really feel that, you know, definitely beware just because it can be inherently, you know, the risk profile with certain areas of alternative investing is just incredibly high and just tread lightly?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I've kind of, as an investor, I've kind of followed the breadcrumbs from a novice investor buying little rental properties. And then when you realize that works, what do you naturally do? But, well, let me go buy an apartment that is like a multiple rental properties. And part of that, what was the investment thesis behind that? Well, you know, other than the basic blah, 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 like, you know, they're not making any more land and stuff like that. I think what I distill my investment thesis off of is like, what are things that the masses use? I do believe that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting bored. And as I kind of mentioned before, it's like the shrinking middle class. And what is the dynamic of that other than workforce housing? And workforce housing is Class B multifamily apartments. You know, people aren't going to be able to live in single, nice three bedroom, two bath, single family homes. It's going to be this people displaced in either build to rent type of communities or apartments. And I like apartments because they're just a lot better to service, lower maintenance because they're all in one place, all under one roof. But that's kind of where, as an investor, you know, we're always kind of like looking to kind of skate where the puck is. Multifamily is a very heated, you know, sector with, you know, a lot of people, they go to like a weekend boot camp and now they think they can go buy a 200, 300 unit apartment complex. We've been there, done that. We've picked over 60, 70 projects. We've kind of drifted off to doing some developments ourselves, you know, still the same investment thesis, right? Workforce housing, it's Class A, but it's stuff that's, you know, pretty reasonable, $1,200 a month for rent for one of these apartments. You know, and I think a lot of, we don't do this, but a lot of investors will kind of move into like self-storage, mobile home parks. Again, it all kind of aligns with this whole, what is the product, the need that caters to the expanding lower middle class. But yeah, you know, real estate's been tough, right? This last year with interest rates skyrocketing. And yeah, you do need a little bit of help on the leverage and debt side, which interest rates really influence within the capital markets. So it's kind of forced us to kind of look up, you know, maybe going into private equity, right? I mean, I'm pretty sure you can use your retirement accounts or self-directed IRA accounts to invest in private equity deals as you're just being a passive investor in a syndication in that. So, I mean, some of the obvious stuff that comes up, you know, that cater towards the lower middle class expansion is, you know, plumbing companies, HVAC companies, right? These home services types of companies that are somewhat recession proof too. And now we kind of get into this whole other world of other professional services companies. This is why you see private equity companies buying up dentist franchises or CPA firms. And this is all, I've even personally joined the local angel group, venture capital. And that's something I thought I'd never do, right? Because I was always saw myself as a value type of investor. I want to invest in things that is making freaking money today, right? It's not just a pipe dream and idea. It's actually making money, like an apartment that you have a P&L and you see what the profit and loss is on a monthly basis, and you buy the asset based off of financials today, not some pipe dream in the future. But as I'm start again, like I think my whole like journey and I continue to do this is like try and figure out what is the people on the next step up. For me, it's like, what is the $10, $50 million net worth people doing with their money? They don't just invest in real estate. They may have started like that, like how I have, but they move off to private equity, which is typically more asymmetric. Asymmetric means that, you know, it's higher risk, but a lot higher return. So if you are somehow able to measure what's called the Sharpe ratio, which is impossible, it's more of an idea concept than an actual formula for you engineers out there who want to figure out what this Sharpe ratio is and figure out what the outliers are. It's like you get better returns based on one unit of risk. And this is the way that higher net worth investors invest. Obviously, they have a lot more money to throw around with it. So it changes the dynamics of it. But this is kind of what's on that next pedestal ahead that kind of I'm kind of exploring and, you know, talk about a lot.
Yeah. And I think you bring up a good point. You know, whenever I hear people talk about, you know, talking about Sharpe or risk adjusted investing or betas, I'm like, look, you know, it's a good place to start. But if you base your whole thesis on that, you'll miss a ton of stuff that comes in because the calculations are imperfect. You know, they can be very well suited towards things like stocks and bonds and mutual funds. You know, they take pretty well account to those kind of things. But especially in the alternative space, it's a lot more hands-on. And I think people don't necessarily realize that, especially kind of changing your mindset from the more traditional side of things to this. You know, you don't have, you know, large K-1s that are issued for these companies. You have to go through and read a prospectus and a PPM. You have to maybe actually sit down and talk with an operator or sit down and actually, you know, again, engage with people on a face-to-face basis to do your investing. And I think that is a very good thing, but it's also, again, something very different. You know, it's not going out and, you know, choosing a new barber or, you know, yeah, your favorite we're not, you know, your favorite bartender that knows your drink order. It's talking about finding the people that are going to be good stewards for your capital. And that is something that even if you have a ton of money, let's say you've been a very successful, you know, rank and file employee, or you've inherited wealth, or you've done well in any other number of things, when it comes to this type of due diligence or understanding what you're investing in, it's a departure. It takes some getting used to and work at it to be good at it. But with that said, you can certainly see the benefit to how these things make money, especially when you look at, again, looking at the people above you, like you said, you know, looking at, you know, I have 5 million of net worth. What are the people that have the, you know, 8 and 10 and 9 figure, you know, net worths? How do they do it? And what's above me? And again, it's more often than not going to be some type of alternative. Now, going back to kind of the sectors of investing, especially when it comes to the things like commercial real estate, you know, you talked about a couple different things. And I think it's interesting that you like to focus on the workforce housing, because so many people out there like to look at the big, sexy, it's like, look at this class A apartment. We have 5 pools, and, you know, the Four Seasons is thinking about renting out the top 5 floors to make them into villas. But that's such a small segment of the economy. We need more housing. You know, people that are as grateful to live in a home, you know, a 3-2 or whatever that might be, and not have to rent an apartment. Granted, if you live in somewhere like New York, it doesn't necessarily hold true, but apartments are going to be what the next generation is more often than not probably going to be living in. And especially with the inherent spread or the delta between the lower middle class and the, you know, upper class, the middle class is shrinking. So focusing on that asset class, I find interesting, and not a whole lot of people kind of come right out and say that's what their focus is. Where would you say that you kind of see the most benefit to that? Is it just simply from a consumption? You think it's going to be the most consumed in the future, or do the returns inherently make it a more attractive option? And is that based on like just a scalability factor, or is it just off the rip that these things inherently can be more profitable?
Well, I'm just looking at just the user base, right? Like, I mean, kind of the joke is like, I'm just a stupid real estate investor, right? What is our inputs? Population growth and or job growth. Those are really the big drivers. And when you kind of look at population growing especially in the lower middle class with, you know, more immigration, right, which is kind of how our country thrives. It's a bit of a no-brainer. And I think that's where value investors, they take a look at these bigger trends. Don't look at things that are here this year or gone 3 years from now, but what are the big trends that are going to be here 10 years plus, and have the confidence to put a good portion of your net worth in there. Maybe even combo a little bit of asymmetric type of deals that are outside of this particular thesis, right? But that's, I think, for new investors getting involved, you want to, it's so out of this world, right? I mean, when I was investing in 2016 in these syndications of private placements, you don't know who you're working with. You don't know, really, you may or may not have owned a rental property before. It's just so out in the solar system that you want to at least believe in the business plan, right? And that's kind of where I think, I'm just, maybe it's the right place to be in, but that's where I started. And that's, I think that's the right, maybe there's somebody better, but I think the right takeaway is that you got to get started doing something, but, and then you'll move over from there. But, you know, maybe we kind of talked about like what's in the future, but maybe bringing it back to the guy who's $1 or $2 million net worth getting started. I mean, that's where I was in 2016. And I think I always like to be transparent with people. I mean, I've lost money with a bunch of like newbie operators, fake it till you make it. This is the most vulnerable portion of entering the game. You know, I mean, I would say 1 out of 5 deals I went into with people, they, you know, they just, one guy ran off with the money, the other, you know, other couple guys, they're just total fake it till you make it incompetent operators. And that's just how it's, I mean, I don't want to say it. That's how it is in a way, until you start to develop a community and network around you to figure out, well, who's proven here, because everybody looks the same. Everybody says they do, you know, $300 million of deals, which is nothing, until you go over $1 billion of assets, then you become a little bit more stable and institutional. But that's, I think that's the harder portion for new investors who don't know what they don't know to kind of enter this world. But yeah, I think like I'm a big proponent of meeting other passive investors and kind of building a community from there.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of a good place to kind of wrap this up a little bit is the personal aspect of this. You know, so many people like to say, oh, I miss how it was, you know, XYZ back in XYZ day. You know, investing in alternatives offers you that face-to-face, that more personal touch to your finances. It's not some mysterious walled garden of Wall Street. It's face-to-face. And like you said, you know, there's certainly some people out there that you can, that are going to be bad actors, but there's bad actors in Wall Street, but they're much more accessible. And once you've kind of learned the questions to ask, you can go ask these people and hopefully you've, you know, you'll gain experience. And if you have people in your community and your circle, such as yourself, Lane, or other people that are experienced, it's a lot easier to kind of figure out, hey, you know, I'm looking at doing this deal. You know, what do I need to ask these people? You know, how can I tell if these people are kind of fake it till you make it? Or, you know, you're never going to know if someone's just going to turn around one day and fly to the Maldives with all the money. But, you know, there certainly are red flags. And it's, you know, nice to be able to have that face-to-face and that personal interaction, and also be able to access people that can help you with that, whether that by be podcast or getting within their networks or reading books. And a strange concept to read a book in 2024, but I do highly recommend them. They've been around for a long time. They have some good information in them, people. So maybe pick one up every once in a while. So Lane, with that said, any kind of parting thoughts that you'd like to leave our listeners with? We've definitely covered a lot of great information today. And as well, I know you also wrote a book. Where can people find that book? Is it Amazon or is it an ebook?
Yeah, they can go on Amazon, The Wealth Elevator. I also do a podcast that I've been doing since 2016. Pardon the earlier episodes, we were talking a lot about buying little rental properties. Obviously, I've moved on from there. But yeah, we talk a lot about taxes and syndications and private placements. But it's kind of just a follow my journey. I mean, I'm kind of learning this myself. And I think, unfortunately, for a lot of first-generation millionaires, there's not really any type of mentorship program for this type of world. I mean, if you're lucky enough to be born with a couple million dollars net worth, good for you. But if history repeats itself, where they say shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves, 90% of people lose their family's net worth in 2 to 3 generations. And unless you kind of learn about this stuff, and then, like I said earlier, get, you know, rubbing shoulders with people investing in these types of alternate investments, your grandkids are the ones that are probably going to blow the family net worth.
Absolutely. Well, Lane, again, I do appreciate you taking time out of your day. The most valuable resource we all have is our time, because we can't make any more of it no matter how hard we try. So thanks for being on with us and spending some time. This has been the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. My name is Alex Perney, and have a great day.
Thank you for tuning in to the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. Tune in next week for more investing tips and strategies.
Want to hear more episodes of the Alternative Investing Advantage? Search podcast at AdvantaIRA.com and subscribe.